I've been working with AI probably for about 4 to 5 years. You know, we've been integrating it, and because I'm always thinking, not how do you replace the people, but how do you make the people perform the best?
Welcome to Friends of Build Magazine. I'm your host, Ted Bainbridge. I've been traveling the world and working in publications for 30 years. In 2016, we launched our first issue of Build Magazine, a publication dedicated to high-end home construction, renovation, and the innovative experts that make this possible. This podcast was created to have some fun and explore those who have taken on the challenge of building luxury homes in demanding locations. From navigating logistics and construction to excavating the earth, we want to learn more about these people and how their projects became cover-worthy. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hey, welcome to the next episode of Friends of Build Magazine. I'm with Jason Herring of Syzygy Global in Palm Beach, Florida. He calls himself a serial entrepreneur and a Elon Musk fan, so I'm curious to dive into this one. We have rescheduled this podcast, I think, 4 times, so here we are. Jason, thanks for, first of all, taking the time. And I was giggling because as I have learned more and more about you, I'm really stoked to talk to you, but the delay, just hilarious.
Yeah, no, I apologize. It was all the rounds.
Oh, you don't have to apologize. These things happen. It's not the end of the world. I'm glad we're finally here.
Absolutely.
So give me a little history on Jason.
Well, I mean, where do we start? You want early? You want now? You want the history?
Well, the whole idea is we want to give people an idea of who you are. It's all about the American dream, and you typify the American dream. You're obviously a risk taker. So we want to talk about that and what motivates you each day. I saw an interesting clip about Steve Jobs yesterday, and Steve Jobs and Elon Musk. And this was a clip on YouTube from Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, yeah, who worked with Jobs because when he had his educational software, Jobs was selling it. Mm-hmm. And Jobs was like, I don't care what the kids say. I don't care what the parents say. They don't do anything until I tell them this is what they want.
I saw the same clip. Yeah.
It's flipping awesome. Well, I mean, he's a total jerk.
Yeah.
But he was also bang on.
No, 100%. I actually saw that clip and resonated with that a little bit. I loved it. And Mr. Wonderful, he's a nut job himself, but I love all these guys, you know, and I mean, it's business. And I just had a talk with one of my staff members this morning and who likes to yes everybody. And she likes to always do things. And I was just explaining to her, I said, you know, there has to be outside of these walls, we are all equal. There's no question about that. We put our pants on the same way. But inside these walls, there is hierarchy. And there's a reason for that hierarchy. So we don't have mass chaos. So, you know, and I was just trying to explain to an executive who's high level pay, you know, don't do the small stuff. We have people that we're paying to do that stuff. Focus on the big stuff. So, you know, I can understand the points from Steve Jobs and these guys. I mean, look what he did. Look at how he changed the, you know, him and Elon. I mean, what they did for humanity, you know, yeah, for business applications. It's incredible. You can be normal and be a nice guy and have that impact. I don't believe.
No, and so after I saw that clip, I shared it with my team, but then I also went down the rabbit hole on YouTube and looked at other, there's a clip, and I'll send it to you after this call, of Jobs in, I don't know, 85 or something like that, and he's at MIT. And one of the questions from one of the students was, hey, what, outside of Apple, what is the most important lesson that you have learned? And the pause was, I mean, he paused for probably 45 seconds before answering the question. How many people do that? Like, he actually gave it serious, real thought. And his answer was, I used to get frustrated with my team and I would fire them. And now I take a more long-term approach as we're trying to create something here. We're trying to create a culture. So now I take a 10-year approach and I go, hey, where are we going to be in 10 years? And now I need to get Jason or I need to get Ted. And while they're frustrating me now, I think to the core, they're smart, they're good, they're whatever. So I need to wrap around and work with them in order to elevate them because Waz and I can only do so much.
No, 100%. Well, you know, that's my approach. And so, you know, to kind of answer your question is to get kicked off, you know, so, you know, I serial entrepreneur, that's just how I classify myself. I used to say, like to say, I'm an eccentric billionaire without the billions yet. So, you know, at, I was in high school, you know, had lawn mowing services. I had snow shoveling services, selling lollipops and candy, you know, so I was always thinking how to make, you know, selling baseball cards, you know, the whole thing. As a matter of fact, I had a box that I never opened and I forgot it existed. And my mom gave it to me when I was around 30. And it was a box of baseball cards. And it said, and I put it away at 8 years old. It said, don't open till you're 30. And it happened to be around 30 when this box came into my life again.
And your mom kept it?
Yeah, she kept it. It was crazy. And so I opened this box and in there, you know, because I was already thinking about, you know, revenue generation back then, I guess. I didn't even know I was. And I had on the cardboard, I wrote all the current values of these cards and what I thought they would be in 10 and 20 and 30 years and their values. And, you know, what the worth of the box would be in three decades. And crazy to see how my mind works back. You know, I was probably 8 at the time when I did that. Crazy. But anyway, so yeah, I moved right at 19, you know, I dropped out of college, didn't like it, didn't think it, you know, I felt it was wasting my time. I moved, just took a backpack and $100. Matter of fact, this is back when Wilson was like the leather jackets at the time. Remember Wilson leather jacket?
So of course.
I had a Wilson leather jacket in the 90s and a JanSport backpack and $100 cash. And I literally took a one-way ticket to London and never came back for 10 years. And over there, I met this guy. He was a great mentor to me, and he owned a very successful development company, and he had 40 branches of real estate offices throughout London. And I knocked on a lot of doors and I said, hey, I'm going to build a software program for you. If I can do it, can I have a job? And I got a lot of no's, and he said yes. And so he gave me a desk, and I, after 2 weeks, I presented him with a software program, and that was I was able to quantify and qualify building materials. And that little piece of software, it was able to basically tell him, you know, how much the building material cost would be on a job site. And I saved him $2 million in loss, the year one of that software being in place. And this was before you had Pro Cores and even a website for Home Depot. So this was at the time. Now this would be nothing. It was cutting edge. And so from there, this guy took.
Hold on. How old are you? Are you 20?
I'm 48. At this age. I'm 20 years old. 20 years old. Yeah, 20 years old.
And where did you grow up?
Upstate New York. I was born and raised. Okay. And then we moved to Florida. My senior year of high school, miserable experience, missed the prom. And then, you know, took me away from the love of my life, who you think, right? And then you went to college for a few years here, and then boom, off on a plane to England.
Okay. So when you say the love of my life, I'm thinking of the Toby Keith song, How Do You Like Me Now, where he couldn't get the beautiful cheerleader. It's a great video. And now all of a sudden he's hugely successful.
Yeah,
God, I love that guy.
And thankfully for me, I found the real love of my life now. So that's even more important. But so I became I became chief operating officer of the company within 2 years. I had a lot of guys that were reporting to me that were 50, 60 years old. They hated me, but I was the tech minds, and we were way ahead of our time. We were doing glass, you know. I said, why don't, you know, we had all the picture frames and all the windows for the real estate agents. And back in the day, if you remember, they were all wires. And then you would have the little plexiglasses, and
every day
you'd have to put in the new, you know, piece of paper. And I said, why don't we try to put the plasma screens just came out. And at the time they weighed like 1800 pounds. You remember? So we had to build. So I said, why don't we rip this out? We'll put a
concrete wall. They're both this thick.
Yeah. And we'll put a plasma screen. We'll put it really close to the glass, and we'll try to develop a software where you could, from the outside, you could touch it and select the properties. Now this to me, this nowadays is these, you know, nothing. An iPhone does that all day. Back then, this was a big deal. So I found a company in Germany that had these magnetic strips that you could implement onto the glass. And, you know, you had a slow migration of touch. And so we did, and it was all line-based. And so we figured out how to make that loop-based where you basically, it didn't matter if you're on a you know, a singular line, and you could actually scroll through the pictures in a real estate office. That was, you know, cutting edge at the time. He loved that. And then I just kept doing projects like that and just innovation. And I eventually made all the real estate offices communicate to one another in real time and way before we had any of the software that we have today. And that's kind of how my took off my career. And that was, it was a beautiful thing because I was learning development. I was learning how to, you know, negotiate large deals. I was a young kid, so I would say no to nothing. So I got to go on a 2-week sailing trip with him to all through Italy with all the board of directors of one of his large companies. And the only job I had was to make sure his BlackBerry could get emails on it. And I said, yes, hell yeah, I'm going to do all these things. So I got to be around these wonderful, great mentor figures in my life because I just never said no. I would, you know, you want me to drive you to the supermarket, get the car, you know, and I would just listen and ask a lot of questions and just kept developing my craft. And the beautiful thing is we were in construction and software and that's kind of where I'm at today. So it's an amazing, amazing journey, really.
That is awesome. So I'm assuming you've seen the BlackBerry movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Just an awesome movie. And I'm from 30 miles from there. This guy was in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and I grew up just outside of Toronto. So to see that movie, and he's a big hockey nut, which I am. So it's funny that you look at that technology and you talk about your iPhone. An iPhone's got more technology than the computers they used in the 60s to get Neil Armstrong on the moon, right?
100%, yeah.
And now it's incredible. Look at some of these videos on Jobs, and Jobs was talking about AI in 1985. In fact, 100%. I just had a meeting with my sales team, and it was like they were talking about AI and how that's going to change their world. And I go, look, at if COVID taught us anything, AI, we've had AI with computers, right? With our phones. They didn't call it AI, but essentially it is. And I said, if COVID taught us anything, it's this is more important than this. This we need, but if you can't talk to people and communicate, you got nothing.
100%. AI is a big deal. We are, you know, I was actually nominated to the board of Salesforce 2 years ago on AI. I've been working with AI probably for about 4 to 5 years, well before it, you know, it was kitchen table talk. And we've been integrating it. And because I'm always thinking, not how do you replace the people, but how do you make the people perform the best?
Yes.
And, you know, and how do we take the minutia out of the day so that we can, you know, we can get to critical thinking? And matter of fact, you know, it's, you know, I try to judge my days these days, not based on how busy was I, but how many critical decisions did I make throughout the day? And that's a hard thing to do as an entrepreneur. You think if you're not running around like a lunatic, you're not performing well. And I really took that advice from Bezos, where, you know, he has all his critical meetings in the morning up until 10 a.m., the high IQ meetings, as he calls them, and then moves on with the day and just making critical results. So, you know, I think AI is allowing us all to be critical thinkers and to get the best. I was listening to Sam Altman yesterday saying how, you know, coders aren't being replaced, but now they can code 10 times faster. You know, even in permitting, it's like in a small nuance in construction, permitting, we all hate that. So we're working with some AI tech right now that will automatically log into all the different permitting offices and allow you to get daily updates and give the feedback in a summarized report at the end of every day. And we're running 80 jobs at a time. So we're able to get that data, summarize it, get a permit update on 80 jobs in what will now take 30 to 40 seconds versus that would take weeks yep. before, you know. So
you make me laugh a little bit because now permitting, now you got to deal with the government. And I think that there might be like a disconnect there as far as pace of play.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. The good thing about COVID, I think, if we talk about the positives that came out of it, permitting actually did get better, because a lot of these agents that are archaic and these government agencies archaic, red tape all over the place, they had no choice but to go digital. So a lot of these municipalities never saw it on the horizon, they finally went digital. I mean, before that, you were having to drop off a packet in an envelope to their front door with a check. I mean, crazy, crazy to think we were doing that in 2020 something.
Yeah.
So COVID did have some positives that came out of it. That's one of them.
Well, and also I think that COVID brought us back together as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like social media is tearing us apart as humans. But COVID definitely brought us back to understand that the nature of we need to interact. It's in our core. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to your adventure in London and France and Germany. What those different cultures, what did it teach you about yourself and how you communicate with people? And then fast forward 25 years, how do you, because I got to believe you still think of those days all the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm.
So the American way of doing business, because we're not a hierarchical, if that's a word, in Europe, it's a hierarchy. So it's very difficult. If you're a plumber, to be more than a plumber, that's just your family trade. It's hard to get out of that. Whereas in America, the beauty of it is anybody can come up with an idea and make it successful. That's the beauty of America.
Yeah. I think, living there has really, I said earlier, I dropped out of college, living in Europe for 10 years was like a PhD in business, just from interacting with all different cultures, all different levels of players and all different institutions and kind of understanding different ways. Everyone's speaking English, but yet so many different cultural differences. And, I'll never forget coming home from England and one day, and I was at the airport and getting a coffee, and these two people were complaining about America. And, I never engaged with them and didn't say anything. And I was listening to their conversation, just, hating on America. And I was gone for, at this point, 10 years. And I'm thinking, man, these guys have no idea how different and hard it is outside of this country. And I think, one of the things from a cultural standpoint, it's so much easier to live the American dream and have access and open doors in this country. And I think a lot of people have comments on it and a lot of people have opinions on it, but no one's actually been out of it. And some people have never even left their zip codes. But yeah, Living over there, just the simple things are difficult. I was talking about this with someone the other day. I think it was my own brother. He said, I'm going to retire in Europe. And I'm like, Europe's a place that you want to have a second home in, but it's not a place you want to be full time in. Cause it's great when you're on holiday, but when you have to get things, like, I'll never forget a moment we had to get a refrigerator, new refrigerator. That's like a 3-month process over there. There's no warehouses. There's no Costco's. There's no inventory. You're in little villages. They're not coming down with the big trucks and dollies and bringing it to your front door. It's a whole production. So even the simple things over there, are a production. But culturally, I think they have us beat. One of the things I love about Europe is people are country proud. You never met an Englishman, a Scottishman, a Frenchman that's not country first, loves their country. So, it's very unique, seeing it from two different perspectives. That really is what put me on the map and gave me a love for America, a love for Europe. And I think it gave me the ability to kind of communicate and work with anybody, and understand cultural differences.
So fast forward, talk to me about Syzygy and some of the other projects that you're, as a serial entrepreneur, and I want to touch on the one that you're taking public, because I got to talk about red tape. I got to believe there's a whole process, and I want to know about the things that you are dealing with that you weren't even on your radar, wasn't even on your radar as far as dealing with those issues. But let's talk about Syzygy and pergolas.
Yeah. So, you know, and nothing's ever on my radar, you know, it always ends up there, but you're never thinking about it. But, so Syzygy was a company, you know, we started in 2017 with my partner, Julie Hallbaker. You know, without her, there's no Syzygy. So we built this thing together and want to make sure she has her credit. But, you know, it was in between, I was getting out of the software and I was doing, you know, a few new projects, and I was kind of working on the other project that we'll talk about in a minute. And so, you know, my father was the general manager at Admiral's Cove up in Jupiter, and CEO.
Yep. Beautiful.
And he was the first ever commercial installation of a what we call a louvered roof, louvered pergola. And he found it at the Chicago Restaurant Show, and he installed it. And he basically said, you know, you should look at this thing. You should try to figure out how to sell these things and see if you can make something out of it. And I never really, you know, people say stuff like that to you all the time, and I never really thought anything about it. But I went up and looked at it, and I thought, wow, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And Julie and me did a little bit of research, and, you know, we got with the manufacturer. It was Scott Seltzer. And we found this guy by the name of Scott Seltzer out of Arcadia. It was the name of the company, now it's Structure. We ended up getting this project, and it was really designed for backyards and for people to have a backyard pergola. And Julie and Maya's vision was, let's, you know, do what I do best and go bigger or go home. And so we figured, how do we make this a commercial sized product? And then we quickly developed that into, you know, 10 years later, what is now the largest commercial and residential installer and designer of pergolas across the country. We then switched over to the Azenco line, because we thought it was really, we could have sold any products, we could have developed our own products, but we thought the Azenco product had the cleanest lines and it was basically more commercialized. So yeah, then we built a great infrastructure, we focused on software, we focused on people, and we built the company, you know, based around software, so we could manage 100 projects at a time. And then that gave us the, you know, from there, we took off. We built the Ritz-Carltons, the JW Marriott's, Pop Strokes for Tiger Woods. We did all the celebrity homes, Michael Jordan's, Tiger Woods, Serena Williams, you name it.
Okay, so what do you learn from those people? And I want to talk about Pop Strokes, since there's one in Scottsdale that I've been to, and I'm a huge golf fan, love Tiger, love his dad, and how his dad drove them. But what do you learn from these maybe not celebrities, but some of the business icons? And you're in Palm Beach, which has so many of them.
Yeah. We've you know, the celebrities are one thing. Could care less about celebrities. But what we've had the luxury of doing is working with some of the best, you know, and I have NDAs with a lot of these client homes, but we've worked with some of the top CEOs at Fortune 100 companies, very famous people you see on the news, and you would know the names. You know, being around them is more, as an entrepreneur, is more interesting to me than any celebrity.
Right.
But you know what that really made me realize, and I've always kind of known this. I've never had a lack of confidence. That's both, you know, a good and bad thing. But and I you know, Obama, even though I'm not a huge fan of him, but he's, you know, I did hear, he's a great speaker, and I heard him, he made a comment and he said, don't ever be, you know, discouraged by, you know, people because of their title. And, you know, he got to do the, you know, G8 summits and the top world leaders of the world. And he said, half of them are idiots. And, I think where I'm going with this is meeting some of these people, A, was inspirational. And it was also at the same time made me realize that, listen, we all have this opportunity, because some of these people, I'm like, how are you in that position? You know, and you know, conversation was challenging. And so, you know, there's a few of them where I was like, wow, I'm in complete awe. I have so many questions. I wish I could ask you all these, but I won't. And some of them are like, man, how are you in this position? And it made me just realize that, listen, we all have this opportunity to do great things. And I don't think it's anything to do with, in America, especially where you came from or, you know, who you are. It's open for open door policy for all of us. So I think that that's the greatest, you know, pleasure I got out of that. You know, and then I did meet, I was in the presence of Michael Jordan. That's the only guy that I found completely, I mean, it's Michael Jordan. He's a GOAT. He's not even a celebrity. He's a fascinating character. The presence of him is just, you can't even describe that. To think a guy like that got that famous before social media is incredible.
And he's super real, isn't he? Like, he's just a regular, nothing fancy. I mean, obviously a billionaire, but I look at Jordan and I look at LeBron, and they are so far apart, like not even in the same league.
Not even remotely.
Okay, so I wanna stop for just a second, and because what you said is so profound, and I want people to understand that super successful people at the end of the day cut their steak the same way we do.
100%. Maybe even not as good.
Right. But you meet them. I remember meeting Jack Nicklaus in the 80s. He's in his prime. And I meet him. I'm a waiter at a restaurant in Toronto, and the Canadian Open was there. And he was, obviously, he's the GOAT. And you look at his record. Tiger, while he was great, if you look at Jack and the history of what he did, unbelievable. And he was just such a nice man.
Yeah.
And I see interviews of him. Everybody that I know that knows him validates. He is just... He was all about his wife, all about his family. Those are the impressive people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Matter of fact, we were just having this conversation yesterday. We had a client. We took some clients down to Coldplay on Sunday night, just the other night. We're at the Coldplay, and Chris Martin, who's the lead of Coldplay, just such a nice guy. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to a Coldplay concert, but, you know.
I'll go now.
Yeah, they're a massive band. They're selling out arenas still 30 years later. But just such a nice guy. Like, you know, in his concert, he truly wanted to be there. He wanted to engage. He read their signs. He brought some people on stage that, you know, were less fortunate and sang him a song. Like, just such a kind soul. Like, you couldn't even make it up. You could feel it. You know, I really like people like that. That goes a long way. Whereas some of these stars, they don't even want to be on this friggin' stage. I'm sure you see Justin Timberlake memes going around right now, too.
I haven't.
Some of these guys are just doing it for their paycheck. Yeah, Google, TikTok that out there, you'll see. Okay. But, it's people doing it for the paycheck or people doing it for the passion. Yeah. You know, and I think really that is the key to everything. I mean, nothing I've always told everyone, like, you know, if you're chasing dollars, forget it. You know, if you chase your passion, money comes easy, I think. But when you're chasing dollars is where you have the issue.
So money to me is always a byproduct of doing a good job. That's 100%. Okay, so just a complete useless piece of information. Did you know that Coldplay was one of the few people, Chris Martin, to be at Steve Jobs' funeral?
I did not.
No. Okay, that I found out yesterday.
Oh, really?
And it was, as I go down this rabbit hole, but I mean, it was a pretty cool rabbit hole learning more about Jobs. And I watched a podcast with Patrick Bet David, who lives in your neighborhood. And I didn't realize that this was from 2010. I did not know that he was a big deal in 2010, but he had Woz on, and Woz was the brains of Apple, no doubt about it.
There
would be no Apple without Woz, and Jobs was the marketing, obviously, genius.
Mm-hmm.
But they talked about his funeral, and the funeral was super small and extraordinarily private, but Coldplay was there.
Interesting. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, I think Steve Jobs' mentality is kind of our mentality here across all companies. You know, we're never chasing competition. You know, we're always 10 years ahead of everybody, and because we're not chasing them, we're chasing ourselves. We're trying to achieve a goal we never can achieve, and just getting better. You don't have to reinvent anything. I like just to take something existing and make it better, you know? And I think packaging and presence and systems is everything. You know, Julie, who's my partner, and it's funny because she's the female and I'm the male with a beard. We walk to a job site and you know, all the guys in hard hats want to talk to me and completely ignore her. And then I'm like, you just really, you know, screwed up because she's the head of, I don't even know how to build these things. She's the head of construction. She'll school them all. But, you know, she's the Waz. And whereas I don't even know how to build a pergola, you know, but what I know how to do is build a company that's great, that's excellent, that, and, you know, our marketing, our systems, our process are incredible. And I focus on those details.
So when I was doing research on you for this podcast today, that's one of the things that I found most intriguing, because my attitude, my whole career, people ask me about competition. I go, my only competition is me, because I can't control what another company does. I can't control what my wife does or my kids do. I can give them directions and I can lead them. Mm. But as far as control, the only person I can control is me.
Yeah.
So I don't get stressed out too easily, because getting stressed about things means that you're out of control. Only stress mm-hmm. about things that you can fix.
100%. No, and I think competition is healthy. I mean, you know, we had the luxury of selling these products in Palm Beach County, Florida, and the whole United States for that matter. But, you know, well, we put our efforts here. Before this product existed, no one knew what a louvered roof was. So we were selling something that you're saying, hey, I'm going to sell you this metal thing. It opens and closes. It shuts automatically. Where's the water go? It comes out the bottom. Don't worry about it. We got that covered. How's it plug in? Oh, we got wires running through it. And, you know, and we had to not only sell this to people, but that had nothing to compare it to. But we had to sell it to the building departments to even let us build it, because they didn't know how to categorize it. So, you know, that to me was our biggest level of excellence, because when you're selling without a competitor, it's 20 times harder than selling with competitors. So I welcome competitors, because they've gave me the opportunity to show how great we are versus inferior products.
Okay. Jason, did you ever think of creating a competitor for yourself? So you were competing with your own company.
I mean, not physically, but I probably in my head mentally.
Okay. I've seen it done before where somebody's in a space, and to your point, if you've got a competitor, then people go, okay, now I got two options. And I think you use the analogy of having a vending machine for Coke and Pepsi, and they're together, makes people buy more of both.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a very well-studied kind of doctrine where basically if you have one vending machine, it has less sales. Then if you have two side by side, they both have double the sales of the one on their own. It's incredible, actually. It's incredible. Yeah. You know, I always say the best thing that happened to Coke was Pepsi. You know, it helped put them on the map.
100%. Now, do your louvers, are they rain sensitive? So if they get water on it, they automatically close?
100%. Not the louvers themselves. The louvers close, but there's a sensor for the system that will shut all the louvers.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. 100%. How tough was it to get into pop strokes? And what's the difference between a commercial application and a residential one?
You know, we spend a fortune on marketing. We spend a lot of resources on marketing. But still to this day, something I'm very proud of is 52% of our sales are relationship-based. 52%. And so pop stroke was not hard to get into at all. I had the contract within 24 hours of even hearing about it. It started at a 1000 North, and, you know, Jordan's restaurant up in Jupiter. We have a pergola there. One of the guys was there. They asked the restaurant owner, Ira, who's a great guy, who built it. He said our name. And the next day they called me and they said, if you're Ira's guy, you're my guy. And we had a contract in place for Katy, Texas, Glendale, Arizona, and I think Sarasota, Florida, within 48 hours. So, it was relationships are everything. Matter of fact, we just did a funny little clip for Instagram about the Coldplay concert we went to, and we just showed us with our clients going around. And, you know, I didn't want to get too political in that whole thing, but we said, you know, we don't just build pergolas, we build relationships, you know, and considering what else took place there. But yeah, so I think relationships are everything. You know, to answer your question, a commercial application versus residential, commercial is a lot easier. There's no emotion.
Bingo.
People leave, you know, I'm a 24/7 guy, so I don't mind putting in hours anytime you need them. But generally speaking, people, you'll like to end, especially on, you know, high IQ stuff, like doing engineering at 5 o'clock. So at 5 o'clock, their commercial team's leaving, our commercial team's leaving. You're not getting text at 1 in the morning, 11 at night. It's just, there's systems on both sides, so it's very professional. So I think commercial's a lot better in the regards of what's easier. Residential, I think, is our bread and butter. We love it as well. Residential can get a little bit more challenging because it is people's backyard, just like I would get a little bit more, you know, on my own backyard. What I love about residential is, you know, when you see a client's face after you've built their pergola and they open it for the first time and they have that joy, it's like getting a new car on your house. So yeah, they both have their perks and they both have their downsides.
Okay. Do you know Dustin Mazel at Environment Design?
I don't know him. No.
I did a podcast with him. His office is in the Paramount Building in Palm Beach. He does all of the stuff at Mar-a-Lago. He's a landscape architect, and I think he just got the contract. And I can say this because he mentioned it on the podcast I did with him. There is a piece of property south of Trump's that's like 250 acres, and it's going to be the first $1 billion house. Yeah. So you came from upstate New York and look where you live. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of a pretty fun world when you actually open your eyes up to possibilities instead of woe is me and everybody, you know, I can't make it and all this stuff.
I came from my dad raised me and my brother. My mother left in the middle of the night when I was 8 years old, and she never came home. So I came from a very...
Dude, how do you do that?
Hard background. No idea. No idea. You know?
I mean, that's a tough story.
Yeah. That story could have its own podcast. But so I come from that. So, you know, anything is possible. Anything is possible. I think you have more chances of being successful. The worse you were, the better you can be. I believe, you know, I think people that are, if you grew up wealthy, I think you have a less chance of success. Cause you're lacking drive. You're lacking, you're never going to be the man that made it. You're never going to be your dad in that case, or you're following someone else's footsteps. I believe people, and I can say this cause I am this, that were less fortunate and had a hard youth or hard, you know, family life, I think you have the greatest chance of being successful, you know, and especially the drive.
Well, it takes a pretty interesting person to be able to be born into a very wealthy family and take the company's brand and move it up.
Yeah.
Like, people can say what they want about Trump. You know, his dad was obviously very successful, but his dad wasn't near, he didn't build what Trump built.
No, not by any means.
And that's not easy to do either.
No, 100%. No, I have a lot of affirmation for him.
Okay, so talk to me about taking this other company of yours public. I'm fascinated with this. Only with all the regulations and the paperwork and the reporting that you have to do to the FTC, walk me through that, and what is the end game on that?
Yeah, and I gotta be. There's still a lot of classified information on that, so I gotta be careful with this. But so that company, that's actually the easy part. That's the very easy part. The hard part is this is a clean air technology project that has the ability to bring coal plants back on the grid. And we've been working on this project since 2012, and we've kind of put it on the back burner because it was very political. It was, you know, we spoke in front of the United States Senate as a leading expert on this, both in Texas and now Alaska. it was crazy. I mean, the lobbyist for coal, before we were about to go on and speak in front of the Senate, came up and shook. Now, bear in mind, I'm going to make them have a better, you know, I'm going to be able to burn their product clean and make them happier. But it's so politicized. He shook my hand. And he said, if you say coal's dirty, right in the Senate floor, I have guys at your house that are just, you're going to go home to no family. That's the crazy. That's, I mean,
what?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Crazy stuff. So we had death threats for years. Like, they didn't want this
in the open.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We had people offer a lot of money just to put it on a shelf, you know, and never use this type of technology because it's, you know, it's so politicized. And so I walked away from it. I never wanted to even hear the word coal. And then I was at Mar-a-Lago at a Trump convention for AI back in September before he got elected. And, you know, little does anyone know, the newest technology in the world, AI, is, you know, needs coal to power it because all the AI data centers. And so it kind of opened that door up again. And now here we are. And we already have about 7 plants we're gonna bring online, and we're gonna start powering AI data centers. And we also have a lot of other cool products too I can't really talk about yet, but basically, yeah. So you talk about going public, that's easy. We were dealing with lobbyists, we were dealing with you know, people that were giving us death threats, we were dealing with the EPA. We were dealing with the president of the United States, Obama, when he deregularized all this. I mean, we were dealing, it was crazy. I mean, crazy. The going public is a walk in the park compared to all this. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, we would have meetings where you couldn't even have windows in the room. It was insane. I mean, we could have a whole podcast on this.
Okay, Jason, it doesn't surprise me, although it does blow me away. And just the thought of, you know, I came from a pretty normal, you know, middle class family, and where the people that we know now, the people that you deal with on a regular basis, you got to sit, whether you're having a beer or whatever you're doing at the end of the day with your wife, and just sitting there going, you know, it's a pretty cool life we live, and we're pretty fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go to Washington and all the BS and the virtue signaling. And my wife and I were talking about this literally yesterday about, you know, windmills, solar farms, all this, which is good. There's no question about it. But it's not going to fuel the AI. These data centers, they eat energy.
Yeah. Well, here's the good thing. And again, all joking aside, we could have a whole podcast on this. I mean, you get me down this rabbit hole, it's not going to end. But, you know, the technologies we have are so advanced that you could, you know, with coal, you could have it singularly so that you're continuing the energy without ever losing the energy. So you could regenerate the coal, turn it into granite, repopulate. And it is, I could bring my chief engineer on this call and he'll blow your mind. We also can use hydrogen. There's also, you know, down the road in about 10 years, you know, maybe 5, you know, there'll be the ability to get 2 atoms and crash them together and capture that energy, which is a massive boom, and use power utilizing atoms. And the funny thing is this technology has been around for a very, very long time. But, you know, one of the things we found is, you know, it's just like I'm into healthy living. I love peptides and, you know, biohacking and red light therapy and sauna and cold plunge. I'm one of those guys. I love it. Love Joe Rogan. And
how do you not?
Yeah. And peptides, if you're familiar with them, are, you know, basically something that's been banned by the FDA. Why are they banned by the FDA? Because they work. Because they will hurt big pharma.
Okay.
And because peptides are basically something you inject in your system that, you know, and there's different variations that they're all natural. They're things we stop producing at the age of 30. So from anti-aging to gut health to muscle recovery to everything. It's basically what aging is. Aging is the lack of these things. So you put them in your body, you age better. Well, they also prevent inflammation, which, you know, is the prevention of 80% of diseases. So you add that with, you know, and so the FDA banned it because it actually will, you know, because of big pharma, you know, they fund the FDA. So, and then you have the EPA. The EPA is funded by the same types of organizations that don't want this clean energy on the table. So it's all so damn regulated. I think if there's one thing everyone should that doesn't like Trump should love about Trump, it should be the fact that he really showed us how corrupt Washington is. And, yeah. You know, I got the tattoo of We the People right on my eye. I love our Constitution. I love our government. But he really showed how, you know, it's just politicized. It's weaponized. And, you know, he really showed that, I think. So like him or not, I think he did, you know, do a job of showing us, you know, it's fake news, this news, that news. You know, be careful how you vote.
Well, and, you know, to me, why is he still here when he got shot in Butler? I mean, there's a reason. There's a mission, and it's way beyond our brain capacity. You know, I'm a firm believer that the Lord had a very clear plan for him. That's why he's still here. And Washington is, it did. You know, the show House of Cards?
Yeah.
Perfect example of just how, and it's so believable because I believe it's true.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's insane. It's incredible. I think so many doors are, so many things are out in the open now, which is good for everyone. But so it's good for us because now because of that, and thank God for Elon Musk. Elon Musk made energy cool. He made rockets cool. He made those conversations a cool topic. Even though he's eccentric as hell, he's remarkable. And I think he's made a lot of that kind of, he's taken the political element out of it and made it about energy and science and engineering. And he made it much easier for us this go. And I give all the credit to him for that. And it's definitely not as politicized now, especially during the Trump administration. But we are running fast because we don't know what's going to happen in 3 years. So we want to make sure we get everyone powered up before a new election happens.
Well, also, we're running fast because that's how those guys run. They want to get stuff done. When Trump says, I can solve a problem in 15 minutes, everybody, honestly, if they wanted to solve a problem, I mean everybody. Putin's not ending the war because he doesn't want to end the war. Yeah. If he did, it would be over by now, right?
100%.
Everybody in their own family. I got a dear friend of mine, Charles from Vesuvius. He's a contractor in Park City. This guy for 15 years was an emergency room doc, and now he's a contractor. And I'm going to introduce him to you because you would love this dude. And he goes, Teddy, there's three things when a patient would come into emergency, he goes, you literally have 2 minutes to decide, are they going to die in the next 2 hours? Are they going to die in the next day or so? Or are they not going to die, but I need to fix them? Because you couldn't get distracted by working on somebody that was going to be fine. I'll get to them. You got to put your attention on, this person's going to die in the next hour or two unless I fix them. Mm-hmm. And how many times do we as humans get distracted with things that really don't matter?
Right.
And that's what Trump's good about is he goes, hey, listen, they fixed the border, and it wasn't Congress that fixed it. It was Trump saying, okay, we're going to fix the border. It was intentional. This is how we do it, and we're done. Now go execute.
100%.
Right?
No, I think it's intensity. It's intensity. This is one of the things I say to my people all the time, and you know, this company or that company. You know, we have problems, and I'm the type of guy that wants to solve the problem in 15 minutes, just like you mentioned. I can't stand when there's a problem and then they email and then now they're waiting on a response and then there's a response and then they respond back. I'm like, just pick up the phone. And if the phone doesn't work, I mean, we had a problem one time in St. Louis. I'll never forget. Major issue with a construction project. No one was answering the phone. My solution was I asked my assistant, find me all the flights out in the next 15 minutes. I literally drove the PBI, hopped on a flight, was in St. Louis in 2 hours and I dealt with the problem. I wasn't waiting for an email. I was on a plane. And so that's how you get shit done. And that's kind of the drive I have in everything. I cannot stand, you know, I don't like a list. I don't want to have something on a list and here's one problem we got to solve and we'll do this next week. This just get it done. If you get, I tell people all the time, if you got one problem done a day, you take care of 30 problems in a month. That's a big month. That's a really good month. You know, you took care and you shouldn't, hopefully you don't have 30 major problems, but you know, you don't need things to drag out years or decades. And, you know, but I think that's what, this is one of the biggest things I'm always constantly working on, is building a great team of great people that work for you and with you and surround you, that can execute your visions. Because listen, I'm not good at managing people. It's not my skill set. My partner, Julie's great at that. Our general manager, John Iannotti, he's great at that. I'm a visionary. I have ideas. I'm like Steve in that sense. I don't know how to do it, but I have the idea, and I need to have the people that can execute it and execute it quickly, so we can you know, see the results of that idea. So execution, whether it be a great idea or problem solving, I think is the key to everything. You know, Mr. Wonderful, you mentioned him earlier, and he's famous for saying, and I do get caught up in perfection, but but Mr. Wonderful's famous for saying, you know, if you want to be a great business, you got to go fast and not perfect, then perfect and slow and never having a sale. Yep. And so I've learned, and you know, social media has taught me this, you know, you just got to get content. But when it comes to print media or website or something like that, okay, I want it to be perfect. But when it's content and everything else, that's where you can just go fast. And so I think execution is the key to everything.
Okay. So that leads into my last question. Now, you already kind of answered this, but you do have to manage a couple of people in your company as we wrap this up. How do you manage smart people? People that are smarter than you, how do you manage them?
That's a good question. Well, first, I always want to be surrounded by people that are smarter than me.
Of course.
And I struggle with that because it's not, I'm trying to build that. I want people to be smarter than me. But I've been around and do manage a lot of great, smart people. And I think, you know, one of them is like the chief scientist for this technology. And a friend of mine was telling me about one of his guys that's in the same field. And this guy has two PhDs, went to space as an astronaut, and has his doctorate. One person has all that. And I think when you have people like that to manage, and you're not managing them from an executive level, you're managing them for more. And I, because I'm in that space with actual rocket scientists, I mean, that's what these guys are doing. I mean, our chief engineer worked for NASA and fixed a cryogenic leach on the Challenger explosion. So I'm working with literal rocket scientists, and you don't manage them. What you do is you keep them on track. Because, you know, someone said to me recently, you know, how do you, when you're in your space, how do you keep up with all the advances? And I said, it's actually the opposite of that. Keeping up with the advances is what your engineers want to do on a daily basis. They want to keep, let's add this, let's add that, let's make it better. It's actually the opposite. We have to tell them, hey, let's just make what the client wants. Let's just stop it here for right now. We can do this later, but we you know, it's keeping it on point, because otherwise what will happen is you'll have a project that will never get completed. You'll never get the patent finished, et cetera, et cetera. So I think managing smart people is the answer to that. And real rocket scientists, literally what I'm doing is not managing them. It's keeping them focused. That's the key for me.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. I really appreciate your time. This has been fabulous. You had so much good information for me. One of the great things about doing the podcast is I learned so much about people, and it's really enjoyable to listen to what you just said. And that last comment, because we're all looking for smarter people mm-hmm. that are smarter because they elevate the company, but it's keeping them on track. It's not necessarily managing them like 100%. This.
Yeah.
It's just, hey, you guys stay like focused. This. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you said about go fast, I wrote it down. Go fast, not perfect. Mm-hmm. Because too many times we get mired in the details. Now, you know, if you're a brain surgeon or a heart surgeon, you want to make sure you're perfect.
Right.
But for what we're doing, you just need to get the message out.
Yeah, I think in a final thought, I think, you know, and I've learned this because I didn't used to think like this. This is something that, you know, as I got older and wiser, was one of those things. But you know, I used to try to do everything perfect, even down to our internal processes, our folder systems, and you just never get anything launched. And then, you know, I finally came up, unless it's going to be print media or web media, that's out there to your client base.
Yep.
You know, you don't have to be perfect on everything. You just need to, you need to get to market, and you need to get to market quick. And then you can make things perfect later, but you know, you don't have to start perfect. That's for sure.
So what's your vision for Syzygy? I forgot to ask this when we're kind of in that part, but I'm curious because I'm a guy who likes to go national and international. Mm-hmm. When you got a good idea, why not expand it? So yeah. What's your vision? What's your plan with it?
You know, Syzygy, we want to grow to 100 million. Keep it at that. You know, it's not the type of thing we could just sell a whole bunch. Because don't forget, we got to build these things too. It's not like I always tell people the cupcake analogy. If you're selling cupcakes, quantities, everything, you know, the more you sell, the more you make. In this business, you know, we've really tried to focus on good quality partnerships. I don't like to call someone we're working for a client. I like to say they're our partner. We're partnering with them on their home, on their build, on their company, and we're building something together. And we like to have good clients that we want to work with. We like to have good, you know, good projects. So, you know, we don't say yes to everything anymore. You know, we're able to pick and choose the projects we want to be on, you know, just doing good quality work and making sure we always keep a level of excellence. You know, I've always seen, and, you know, and I'm always very careful. You see these celebrity chefs, they're most famous for it, where they're a celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay's of the world, Jamie Oliver's. They do really great. They open their first restaurant. It's the hottest thing. They do 30 million a year, which for a restaurant's crazy. Yep. And then they open 20, which they're not the chef of all those 20. And then 2 years later, their whole empire is bankrupt, you know? it's their whole empire is bankrupt. And rather than just focusing on that one thing, maybe have a couple more, but you know, and I think it depends on what you're doing. You're just trying to have a quick exit, or you're trying to do good quality work. And with Syzygy, you grow to 100 million, just keep good, great clientele. We have a great infrastructure and, you know, cap it there, because in this particular business model, because we are building things, Syzygy would eventually go dead and would not survive if you just sold to anyone and everything, because eventually if it didn't have that stamp on it, the Syzygy stamp of approval, you would lose quality, and then we would be like any of those other restaurateurs. So I think when you're making something in this world, you know, quality first and scale to where you can keep that quality at a high level. And that's where I try to be perfect.
So was it difficult when you did Pop Strokes outside of Palm Beach or South Florida? Was it difficult to install it?
No. And here's why. Again, going back to Julie on this one, we built such a great infrastructure, such great policies and procedures. And we use software so heavily that the job to me is the same job if it's in a mile up the road or in Nantucket. The only difference is we had to travel there, but we have great crews that travel. We shipped all their tools over there with, you know, in a U-Haul. And so they're using their same saw. It's the same guys. The only difference is we have travel expense. Apart from that, it's the same crew. They're talking to my office here. We always say this office, no matter where you are, this is the mothership. We're the control tower. So we have a great administrative team here, a great permitting team. We have a great GM. We have a great marketing team, sales team, director of construction, field managers, warehouse managers. So this team here is the mothership, kind of, you know, giving all the information out to the field, and we keep that quality.
Well, I appreciate your time, Jason. My wife and I are going to be in Palm Beach the 7th to 11th of September.
Come and say hello.
Well, I'd love to, whether we have dinner or something, I'd love to. Yeah, we need to connect. Awesome. Okay, Jason, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, man. I look forward to meeting you in person. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below. I'm Ted Bainbridge, and you've been listening to Friends of Build Magazine podcast.